Full Service Radio is proudly supported and hosted by Simplecast, the easiest way for a podcast creator to publish and distribute audio on the internet. For more information, visit simplecast.com.
Recorded live from the lobby of the Line Hotel in Adams Morgan, Washington, D.C.
Hey everybody, it's Nikki Nellis. Welcome to Industry Night live at the gorgeous Line Hotel. We're here in the lobby, so if you're staying here at the hotel, come on down and wave hi. You can see me in studio today. Now, I'm normally not on Thursdays. I'm actually normally on Mondays, 5 to 6. And Industry Night is an extension of all the other things that I do in the D.C. food and wine scene. The website, thelistareyouonit.com, directs you to every food and wine event going on in the D.C. metro area. Of course, you can tune in every Sunday live to Foodie and the Beast. We just celebrated our 11 years on air. That's my husband and I. I am clearly the foodie, and he is clearly the beast. He likes to not pay anything for his food, and I like to spend lots of money on my food for all sorts of food. All kinds of food, and my shoes and my clothes as well. But anyway, I have been covering the DC food and wine scene for the last 17 years, and I am so fortunate that I also get to speak to you here once a week from the Line Hotel to do a deeper dive on really cool things that are happening in and around the city. Now, sometimes it's a little bit of fashion. Sometimes it's a little bit of culture. Most of the time, it's about food. And today, I am so excited because I'm getting to interview two people who are a part of a much larger food movement, the joy of cooking. Unless you've been living under a rock or you don't cook or you don't care, the joy of cooking has been around and has been in cooks' kitchens since the early 30s, 1930s. And I certainly grew up with it. My mother always had one sitting on her kitchen counter. I've had an iteration or two as well. And now, lucky me, I have the very newest iteration, which had just dropped. And in with me are the two authors. Now, talk about a family affair. That's what I think is so fascinating about the joy of cooking. Originally in 1931, Irma Rombauer produced this on her own, self-published, this massive tome of cooking, and then brought in her daughter, Marion, who then brought in her son. And now we have her, Irma's great-grandson, John, and his lovely wife, Megan, in studio with me today. This is the 9th release. Am I correct?
That is correct.
Oh, my God. 9 releases. I mean, your great-grandmother must just be smiling down. I mean, what an amazing legacy to have. But I want to welcome you both in studio today. Thank you so much for joining me. Congratulations on adding even more to something that I don't know if a lot of people think there's more to add, there's more to say, because it's such a massive entity. But I'd really like to start with you, John. If we could just talk a little bit about the history of Joy of Cooking.
Sure. So my great-grandmother, Irma, she was, you know, she grew up in a time when women did not necessarily have professional training. And she married at a fairly young age and had two children with her husband. And her husband, unfortunately...
And where were they?
They were in St. Louis.
Okay.
Yes. Her husband, unfortunately, contracted a terminal illness, we think cancer. And he also was, might have had some psychological issues that went undiagnosed. But those two things combined, and he ended up committing suicide.
Oh.
Yeah, I know. It's kind of weird.
Let's start this off on a really good note.
I know. Like,
no, but it's important.
The joy of cooking starts with something that's kind of macabre like that.
But it's an important part of the history of the book.
No, absolutely. And I feel like it, it kind of speaks to Irma's gumption, because, he left her with maybe a year's salary or so. She took half of that and she just got a wild hair and decided, despite the fact that she had no professional training or even a reputation as a good cook, that she was going to, research and test and then self-publish this book, I'm still flabbergasted that it worked.
So when she did it originally, how big was the book?
It was not very big. It was like maybe, I want to say around 300 pages.
I mean, that is I mean, it's not big in comparison to what it is now, but at that time, that's a pretty comprehensive cookbook, 300 pages.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it was the next iteration when she actually got picked up by a publisher in 1936 mm-hmm. that it really just ballooned. And she, of course, like the 1936 edition, she introduced this very unique characteristic recipe writing method called the action method.
Right.
Where you know, the ingredients are listed in the order that they are used in the directions. So that way the recipe reads kind of like a narrative.
Like a story.
Yeah, like a story. And mm-hmm. and then that way you're not necessarily losing your place when you're trying to refer to the recipe in the kitchen. It's a little harder to maybe put up a grocery list together, but, you know, it really makes sense where it counts when you're kind of, you know, kind of juggling pots and pans and trying to
get
things.
But she really set the future of recipe writing. You'd be hard pressed to open up a cookbook today that's not written in that way.
It's still pretty unique. Like, you know, Alice Waters has put out two books. Mm-hmm. I think it's The Art of Simple Cooking, 1 and 2.
Right.
Those are written in the action method.
Okay.
And then also Elizabeth Pruitt of Tartine. She uses kind of a action method like format for her book Tartine All Day.
Okay.
But yeah,
I have over 1500 cookbooks.
Oh wow.
And I feel like a lot of them are written in that way that lead you through it so that you're not lost when you're cooking.
Right. I guess where most cookbooks have like a separate ingredient list,
mm-hmm.
Hers do not. They just have it like interspersed in the direction.
Right, yeah, as a part of it. Right. No, I guess so. I guess there's a little bit of both now that I'm thinking about it. But no, you're right. So she came up with that method. And then how did she grow from there?
Well, yeah, so that first edition also added over 2,000 recipes to the original. Like, I mean, I want to say that there were probably about 500 in that first book.
And what was her research? I mean, what was her focus at that time?
I mean,
plus, think about the history of where the United States was at that time.
Right. No. I mean, like, the first edition was published during Prohibition mm-hmm. and also at the height of the Great Depression.
Right.
You know, I think that it's fair to say that a lot of people had, you know, help that were cooking for them, mm-hmm. You know, before the Great Depression that, you know, all of a sudden they could no longer afford. And, you know, that's definitely part of it. As far as like, you know, her rationale for increasing the number of recipes, she was very ambitious with that second edition first published.
Mm-hmm.
And then Marion, after that, you know, she started, well, she was doing artwork for the first editions, like paper cuts. She did the cover, which depicts St. Martha of Bethany, like the patron saint of cooks, shooing a dragon out of the kitchen. And a dragon is like this is all from like medieval French, you know, what is it called?
Lore.
but it's called...
I promise we're going to get to you, Megan. No worries. Will not sit there quiet. I promise.
No, it's called a Tarrasque. And it's funny, you know, Google images of it. It's pretty funny. It's like a cross between a turtle and a dragon and mm-hmm. like Mothra or something. It's really, really funny to look at. Anyways, so she did that paper cut and then also the chapter headings. But then in the 1950s, for the 1951 edition, she mm-hmm. started contributing in terms of like research. She wrote the bread chapter, which was, you know, just like a very systematic and very thorough way of, you know, a very thorough approach to introduction to bread baking.
Sure.
And then so Irma passed away in 1962. Marion takes over the revision process and then proceeds to just blow it up. She reorganizes the entire book and with the intention of really trying to turn it into a kitchen reference manual in addition to a cookbook. So, I mean, I think that her dream was to always have it as a total kitchen work, kind of like...
like an encyclopedia.
Right, like the Larousse Gastronomique, but for American cooks.
Mm-hmm.
And so she continued that in the 1975 edition. And those really are like where we drew our inspiration for the most recent revision, is we really wanted to kind of expand upon and move her project forward, you know, adding all of the new ingredients that we can find now at grocery stores mm-hmm. and, you know, obviously taking into account some culinary trends that we think might stick around for 10 years, which is, you know, that's our ideal publication schedule, is like every 10 years. So,
okay, right, because the last one was in 2006.
That's correct. Right? So we're a little behind schedule.
Well, it's okay. Hey, no judgment. Right? I'm lucky I got out of bed this morning. So, so let's talk about the two of you. So John and Megan, how did you guys meet?
I was working in a bakery in Asheville, mm-hmm. North Carolina in 2010. Mm-hmm. And, I had purchased The Joy of Cooking for myself when I moved out of my parents' house, a couple years prior to that. And I loved the book. It had taught me a lot of things about cooking. I learned how to roast a chicken from Joy of Cooking. I learned how to make apple butter from Joy of Cooking. So I was talking about
apple butter can be a real pain in the tush to make.
It is a pain. It takes a really long time. Yes. And I always burn myself when I make it, no matter what.
It does have like that that magma effect every now and then.
I just want to say, like, that makes me feel so much better.
But I was talking to a coworker at this bakery about The Joy of Cooking, and he said, well, didn't you know that the guy whose family wrote The Joy of Cooking works at that coffee shop down the street? And I was like, no, and that doesn't seem right. That seems impossible. I don't think that there's anyone still behind this book. Like, I think the authors are gone. And so but I had to check it out. So after my shift, I went down to the coffee shop and asked the barista if he knew anything about that. And it happened to be John who was working.
What a great story.
He sort of raised his hand and sheepishly said, yes, that's my family. And then we started talking, and I ended up asking him out on a date, and we hit it off. And not that long after, we started both working for Joy of Cooking.
So you were not doing any, because I know you were doing some research and you wrote a book, or you helped with a book.
Well, yeah, no, at the time, before we met, I had been working with a former professor on a series of books as an editorial assistant. I was also writing some essays for these books, but they were all like kind of.
It's history, right?
It was like literary criticism, but like, you know, kind of geared towards a collegiate audience.
Okay.
But you know, like straight to library titles, you know, like one of those things that you would never see in a bookstore, but maybe on, library shelves.
Okay. So at this point, are you shunning The Joy of Cooking?
You know,
'cause your dad is involved, correct?
Correct. And you know, he was always, well, let's just say that Ethan, my father, he has had like kind of a fraught relationship with the book and with the publishers, especially our former publisher, Macmillan. He actually spent a good decade and change basically trying to struggle to maintain editorial control for the family.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, at a certain point, they were actually withholding royalties in order to try to force him to play ball.
Did they just want it for themselves?
Well, they definitely wanted to just have more control.
I mean, I'm not looking in a slamming session, but I'm just... listen, there are lots of people who listen. Everybody thinks they can write a cookbook, right? They think it's so easy. Yeah. And they think there's a lot of money in it and blah, blah, blah. And I've had tons of cookbook authors in here. And I know, you know, how hard that process is, and getting an agent and then having somebody advocate for you with the publisher is very important. So given how long this book has been in publication, did they just want it?
Yeah, they wanted to keep Joy of Cooking as a brand, but maybe ditch the family as an editorial force. But, you know, luckily, Ethan was able to really advocate for the book and for the family. And then obviously, you know, there were two previous editions, the 1997 edition and the 2006 mm-hmm. edition, which he was able to, you know, facilitate and work on with Scribner, our current publisher.
Okay.
Who we've had a great relationship with.
We love Scribner.
No, they've actually been a dream. They gave us so much editorial leeway, and they basically just left us alone and gave us help when we needed it, and that was perfect.
That is perfect.
Yeah.
And one would hope that given the history and length of time and that this book has been around, and it's not like this book is wallowing somewhere. You know, people, everybody knows The Joy of Cooking. It is a necessary must on every cook's counter. And I'm not just saying that because you're both sitting in here. I mean, everybody knows The Joy of Cooking. So, and the fact that it is from a family, I think makes it even more endearing.
Yeah, I feel like we're the only multi-generational cookbook out there, really.
I think you are.
Yeah.
So when did you decide to get back in? I mean, did you pick up the phone and call your dad and were like, I'm ready?
So Ethan always he didn't discourage me, but he knew that it was maybe not my cup of tea. And so he would just like kind of, you know, was follow your dreams. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I went to college, and, you know, I really thought I wanted to do literature and, you know, maybe become a professor at some point. And so that's what I was doing. I was, you know, helping publish these books. But, you know, I just started having second thoughts. And at a very, you know, kind of, I guess, impressionable moment, I encountered a, it was actually Marianne's dedication to the 1963 edition. It had slipped my mind to read the 1963's dedication, but at any rate, I encountered it for the first time, and, you know, reading it kind of sparked, like, a lot of emotion in me. Mm-hmm. It was really the last part. It was, Marianne finished it with, I hope that my sons and their wives continue to make, to keep joy a family affair, beholden to no one but themselves and you, you being the readers.
Of course.
And I don't know, it really just, you know, it was a kind of a gut punch to me. And it was the first time that anybody had ever really, you know, and really no uncertain terms was like, please continue this.
Well, it was a little prescient. I mean, clearly, yeah. Maybe she already saw the writing on the wall, but clearly it was very important to her to keep it in the family.
Right. And, you know, the 1963 edition also was like the first one that she had taken over. And so she was thinking about Irma and, you know, what Irma had kind of bequeathed to her, the tradition that she had, you know. Mm-hmm. And I think that all of that kind of, it really created a lot of emotion in me.
Well, I think, and also, you know, speaking of that, I think Irma and Marianne fought so hard to keep the book in the family because mm-hmm. they've also faced a lot of struggles with their publishers. And, you know, if you are interested in culinary history, Anne Mendelsohn's book, Stand Facing the Stove, goes into a ton of detail about the joy of cooking and the history of the joy. And so I think both having that experience probably led Marianne to want her family to continue on with the book and not have it get sucked up into a publishing house mm-hmm. and just become kind of just a brand without anyone behind it.
Well, Megan, when the two of you started dating, where was your head at? Were you like, I mean, you already had an affinity for the cookbook, but were you like, I want to get in this?
It wasn't really from that angle. I think I met John and we just hit it off, and he's a very lovely human being. And we have a really strong relationship. And do you have something to add?
This is not a visual medium, but I am blushing.
Aww. I love that.
No, so I wasn't thinking that, you know, I would ever work on the book. It was more just, that's amazing that there's still someone behind this book and that there's a family. And you know, I got to meet John's dad and, you know, learn about the history. And then after a while, you know, John had decided he wanted to work on the book before we met. And so the next step for him was to actually start doing that. And I kind of got pulled into doing it as well. And so that's kind of how that all got started.
Yeah, the first step was I was supposed to go to culinary school, of course, because that's, you know, that's what you're supposed to do. Mm-hmm. But Megan managed to, well, she totally derailed that plan, which... in retrospect, was probably, you know, saved us some money and also, you know...
Time.
And also get, you know, it allowed, I think it was good to approach the revision from the point of view of an amateur, mm-hmm. You know, just because you know the right questions to ask, you know. nothing assumed, you know, like starting from like kind of that basic, you know...
Well, for people who don't know what it takes to revise and then add to a book. What is the process? How do we get into that, especially something that's so beloved?
Well, for us, you know, when we first started working for the family, a revision was, you know, we talked about it with, you know, like maybe sometime in the future. But what we really did was we started by just testing recipes, with cooking through the most recent edition, the 2006 edition.
Okay.
And as we did that, we would research each recipe and make what we called genealogies of them mm-hmm. to see like when they were added to the book, you know, in what edition, what page number, so we could easily reference them.
So every recipe got a history.
Right. Exactly.
I love that. That's cool.
Yeah, and you know, if there were major changes to the recipe, we would try to note that as well. But
so you could sort of watch over time,
yeah, mm-hmm.
how in each edition how a recipe modernized.
Yes, exactly. And also lots of recipes, actually the titles of the recipe changed also, so that, you know, we had to do some digging to find, you know, you might have the same recipe in multiple editions, but it might be called something different.
Well, I mean, we were sort of talking about this off air. I mean, if you think about 1931 and 2019. The availability of product and our worldwide knowledge, because all you have to do is go on the internet, what we know and how we know and our access to it is entirely different than 100, you know, almost 100 years ago. So it changes everything, right?
Yes.
So Irma's envision of what a Chinese dish may be, right?
Oh, exactly.
You know, yeah. is completely different than obviously what it really is, but also what's available to us now.
Yeah, I think that she had a recipe for chow mein in the 1931 that called for meat glaze.
Mm-hmm.
You know, meat glaze as opposed to soy sauce, because I guess that she didn't have access to soy sauce.
No, I'm sure not.
But
yeah, everything has changed since 1931.
Right,
absolutely
exactly.
everything.
I'm. Oh. That's why. Okay, sorry about that. Yes, everything has changed since 1931. So, but you're not working off of the 1931 book.
No.
But you did a genealogy.
Yeah, yeah. We just wanted to see, you know, how things had changed. And also it was a way for us to familiarize ourselves with the publication history of Joy.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, of course I grew up with the book, but a lot of that was, you know...
You were like, Dad, yeah. I know, I got it.
A disinterested youth.
Yes, I have multiple ones of them, I understand. That's who is just calling me right now, actually. So what was your family's response to wanting to get back involved?
Very supportive.
Mm-hmm.
You know, yeah, it was just a kind of a question of like how to proceed with that. And so what it really amounted to was us kind of moving into a cabin near where my dad was living and have doing this apprenticeship where we, you know, did all of this recipe testing and research. And then that morphed a little bit. Maybe within 2 years, we were approached by an app developer.
Mm-hmm.
And we were like the lead family members on that. So we helped the app developer basically turn... essentially Word files into, you know, an app, which meant, you know, it meant taking it apart, putting it back together,
sure.
you know, tagging, you know, trying to, you know, build that, I guess you would call it it's kind of HTML code, but, you know, like just a structured, kind of a highly structured version of the Joy of Cooking.
Mm-hmm.
And that gave us like a really, I think it was a wonderful experience. It gave us a fantastic insight into how the last edition was really put together. And from there, we really understood, well, we began to understand, like, what we would, you know, what we wanted to see in the next edition, what we felt was missing, what we could be doing better. Yeah.
Well, I'm sort of curious. I mean, especially, Megan, since you were more new to the table, so to speak, what did you see in the book from the 2006 edition? And given the history that you followed up on and learned, what did you see? You're like, okay, this is some of the things that need to be put in here.
Well, I think when we first started working on the book, we were both very, maybe a little overly reverent and thinking that we can't change anything. We can't say anything negative about this book. We can't criticize it. But then as we worked on it more and more, we began to have more opinions, both about individual recipes that we felt were outdated or recipes that hadn't been brought into. So like when you're writing a cookbook, you have a recipe's style and you say things in a certain way throughout your book and you want it to be very consistent.
Mm-hmm.
So that your readers can kind of learn the voice of the book and follow it more easily. And some of the recipes, you know, we like to say that Joy of Cooking is kind of like a cathedral that's been built over many generations. And so there's one wing that will look a certain way and another wing that looks different and another that looks still different. And Joy is much like that. Because of having different authors, they're a little bit of different styles. And some of that is very charming, but some of it is a little vague. So we wanted to make sure all the recipes were really up to date and very clear in their instructions.
Mm-hmm.
But also just research on ingredients and techniques that we felt needed to be improved or things that needed to be fact checked. So that's
I need some
all...
examples. Let's talk about, like, let's think of some examples of products that are either now available or techniques that you feel people are maybe have a better understanding of.
Well, I think we have added some new techniques in this edition. For example, we added information about sous vide cooking.
Mm-hmm.
And about working with electric pressure cookers versus stovetop pressure cookers, which that's been in the book forever. But electric pressure cookers are new. Another example is when we were going through the Know Your Ingredients chapter, which is just kind of a glossary of commonly used ingredients. And we were working on everything from, you know, the section on dried chilies. So we maybe had half a dozen varieties of dried chilies in the last edition.
It was like a half a dozen, and I think the new edition has, I want to say the count is somewhere around three dozen.
I mean, it makes sense.
Just a big expansion of those ingredients because there are so many more available now.
And because we live in the Pacific Northwest, fresh mushrooms, wild mushrooms were like a big priority for, quote unquote, wild. I mean, a lot of them are cultivated.
Sure.
But that was a big priority for us, like, you know, as far as like, you know, kind of dealing with more different varieties. But, you know, some of it just was also just making the recipes themselves better. Like, for instance, like there's a seafood and sausage paella recipe from the 2006 edition that spans a page for us. And that is a lot. That is a huge, huge recipe. And it involved multiple onerous steps. And, you know, that kind of thing we really wanted to deal with as well. Like, if we felt
Did you just want to streamline it a little bit? Do you feel like people are not cooking at home like that as much?
Well, we didn't want to dumb anything down.
Right.
But there were some recipes that were unnecessarily complicated or just we felt like we could make them easier to follow, not necessarily making it simpler. I mean, it was making it simpler, but
in a
positive way.
That and the cassoulet recipe, we tried to really simplify. Those are good examples. But a lot of the time, it, you know, even if, you know, a recipe, you know, really seemed like it was creating too many dishes, we tried to figure out how to use two pots instead of three or, you know, what have you.
How to cut it down a little bit.
Yeah, yeah.
So how did you go about, like, as you were revising, before you were adding, how did you go through the book? How did you decide what was staying, what was going? And sort of there's massive information in the beginning of the book. There's lots of education in there.
Sure.
And how did you, and that's not new, that's something that's always been a part of the joy of cooking, but it is modernized. So how did you go about doing that and your research to sort of bring it up to date? Even though, I mean, 2006 is not that long ago, but like you said, I mean, sous vide cooking was something only done in the, you know, Michelin 3-star restaurants of France.
Exactly.
I mean, Cuisine Solutions is actually here in Virginia, and they are the producers of sous vide cooking. But people weren't doing it at home, and people probably didn't even know what sous vide cooking was. So, I mean, there is so much more available now.
Yeah, we were definitely on the fence about whether or not it should be in the new edition until, you know, the prices plummeted on immersion circulators. I mean, they're cheaper than a KitchenAid, obviously.
Right.
They're cheaper than you know, a really nice knife. So, I mean, like, as far as, like, the reference information goes, it was really, like, just extreme thoroughgoing skepticism. In general, though, we created an overview after reading the book, like, maybe three or four times line by line.
How many pages is it? I mean, that's not
1,100
easy.
Pages.
It's a lot. It's an investment.
Yeah, it was. No. And, you know, every time we would go through it, you know, we would continually add more and more, like, either critiques or ideas for what to add or, you know, suggestions for things that might be taken away that might, you know, recipes that are long in the tooth, perhaps.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it was a really, like, you know, a case by case basis, literally recipe by recipe. We were deciding, like, obviously we tested it.
Right.
Even more granular, like you said, we were going through the book line by line. So if a recipe felt like, even if one line was out of place or something felt a little off or the head note was a little silly, we wrote everything down and we're like, okay, we're going to change this. We're going to edit this. This sentence is weird. You know, just like a very, very detailed outline.
Mm-hmm.
And that was, I don't think we could have done this revision without doing that first because it is such a huge book.
Okay, so I'm going to interrupt for just a second because I have so many questions. But first and foremost, how long have you guys been married?
7 years.
So did you start this project before or after you got married?
We were working for Joy of Cooking before we got married, doing recipe testing, but we officially started the revision after we got married.
Because I feel like, and my husband, I'm literally taking this term from my husband's mouth, and I've been married for over 23 years. I feel like that this would be a round of You Bet Your Marriage with some of the things that you guys are doing. And on that note, we're going to take a break. So when we come back, we're going to find out if their marriage will remain intact now that the book is finally out. This is Nikki Nellis. I'm live on Industry Night at the Line Hotel. I'll be back in just a sec. Hey, everybody, it's Nikki Nellis. Thanks for tuning in to Industry Night. I am so excited because I am talking with John Becker and Megan Scott, who are behind the latest iteration of The Joy of Cooking. Over 11,000 pages of fabulous recipes and information that you absolutely must have if you like to cook, if you're thinking about cooking, if you know somebody who wants to cook. This is the encyclopedia that belongs on everybody's kitchen counter. I don't know what iteration I have on my, well, I know what I have now because I have the new one. But my mom gave me one when I was in college. So I think that's the one that's dog-eared and stained and, you know, beaten up. That has been gracing my counter and through all my paths in life. So the two of you got married 7 years ago. You were just starting then to do recipe testing for The Joy of Cooking, but then you decided to take on the monster to do the, am I wrong? Is it? I mean, it sounds like a monster.
It is. No, it was.
It's a beast.
And I don't think we, even though we had a pretty clear-headed idea of how much work it would take, I don't think we could have ever imagined how much work it would actually take.
Because I want to assume that this was the only thing you were doing, right? Like, it took over your life.
Well, it was full time for me. Megan actually
has a second job, which I felt a little bit insane for having a second job. But
yes,
health insurance is
right.
Important.
I understand. I see where that's going. So how did you guys divvy it up? And Megan, being sort of the first outsider to kind of be a part of this in this capacity, since it's such a family affair, how were you able to carve out your space in it?
Well, we both collaborated on everything, mm-hmm. every aspect of this project, from making that huge outline to doing recipe development and recipe testing to doing research and actually the writing, so the narrative writing that's in the book of all the reference information. Mm-hmm. We both did some of all of that. I would say that I'm a little bit heavier into the recipe development side of things, and John...
Especially the baking.
Yeah, especially mm-hmm. the baking, and John is more
into
the research.
Your background's in baking, right?
Yes, I have some baking in my background, mm-hmm.
And what about your dad? Was he like, did you ever look at some of his writing and be like, what was he saying here? Did you call him up and be like, Dad, what's going on?
Well, yeah, sometimes.
Okay.
Sometimes I would have questions for him. I mean, sometimes the writing would actually date back to Irma or Marion, so I didn't have the opportunity to ask them the question.
Right, of course.
But, yeah.
But I think your dad was really happy for us to take it, and he didn't have to think about it anymore. That's the impression that I got.
A real passing of the baton, or passing the torch, so to speak.
Take it, please.
Yeah, please, God.
I've said all there is to say. Well, with the drastic change in the way Americans eat today. Now, I know the book is global, but I assume you're writing it. Are you writing it with an American audience in mind? Who are we writing it for?
Oh, absolutely.
Definitely.
Okay.
Yeah.
So we're writing it for the American audience. As things have changed, we talked about the sous vide cooking component, but ingredients, things of that nature, the recipes that you're putting in, are they more authentic, would you say? I mean, don't you think people are craving availability to cook more authentic dishes from regions all around the world?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, you know, in the 1997 edition, we added a pho recipe, and we also added a pad thai recipe, but they were not necessarily they're not up to the standards, I think, that we would now expect of those recipes.
Mm-hmm. Sure. So first of all, back in 1997, there wasn't a pho place on every corner.
Exactly.
Right? I mean, if you live in a city, a metropolitan city, and, you know, there were not a ton of Thai places. You know, if you were in middle America, I don't know. I mean, I was in... outside of New York City. Do you know what I mean? There was. So
right.
I think it just depended on where you lived.
For sure. I mean, and, you know, I grew up in Portland, Oregon, and I think my mother started taking me to the local Thai restaurant when I was in second grade.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But, and so, you know, that's another thing, is that we definitely feel, or at least I feel like I've grown up with a lot of these foods. I mean, I think my Filipino-American roommate was taking me to a pho restaurant, like, when I was in high school.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just like things that a lot of us are now like so accustomed to and not necessarily afraid of trying to reproduce in the kitchen. And we definitely felt like we needed to not only, you know, revisit those dishes and try to make them, you know, just like better, just better recipes, more flavorful recipes, like perhaps a little fewer punches pulled as far as like seasonings go. And of course, like, you know, fish sauce and like all of the, you know, kind of quote unquote challenging ingredients that a lot of people are just
no longer. I mean,
they're not.
Yeah, they're everywhere. They're easy to find.
Any market, right?
Yeah, you don't need
a Dean & DeLucas anymore. I mean, not that they exist. But, you know, you could go into anything from, in this region, a Safeway, which is, you know, a regular grocery store, and you will find all those ingredients and more, which I think is fantastic.
Yeah, the American culinary landscape has certainly changed, even, you know, within the past 10 years, for sure. The fact that you can go into pretty much any supermarket and find fish sauce or gochujang, or, you know, people are not, and also I think people are not apprehensive about those flavors. Like, people have learned that they love really flavorful food, that they love spice. And so I think we were definitely, emboldened to make these recipes. I don't love the word authentic because I feel like, you know, Joy of Cooking doesn't get to decide what authentic Thai food is.
And it also changes over time.
It does change.
And so people, so for example, your, the pad thai you ate when you were in second grade is, you know, that's a food memory, right? And you think of like that as pad thai, but I have my pad thai memory, and then I had real pad thai, and I was like, oh, I don't know what I was eating. Yeah. It was delicious, but it's not the same
thing, right?
So, and I think it's no different with a slice of pizza. If you grew up outside of New York City, you're eating a certain kind of pizza than if you grew up in Chicago or in Portland. So, you know, all these terms are flexible. They have room to grow because everybody has their own memory of what that food is and what it's supposed to taste like.
Absolutely. You know, it's, those terms are malleable. The dishes are malleable. And that's one of the reasons why, you know, we feel that it's really important to, you know, update the book every 10 years because whether we like it or not, you know, things are always changing. And
so what about things, you know, I'm sure maybe not for Irma, but maybe more for your grandmother. Farmers markets, things of that nature. Farmers markets, sustainability, trying to stay local, you know, all those sort of buzz terms that are really big right now in the food space. Was that something you took into consideration in the book?
Absolutely. You know, Marion was actually fairly on, you know, ahead of her time as far as sustainability issues go. I mean, she, even in the 1975 meat chapter, she really was like, we need to look forward to, you know, we need to look to grains and legumes instead of meat to be the center of the table. And I feel like we've also tried to, you know, emphasize how, you know, meat should be a secondary part of the meal rather than necessarily like the thing, you know.
The center of the plate.
The center
of
the plate with like some small vegetable sides. It should be like big vegetables, lots of grains with maybe a little bit of meat. I think that that's a good first step if you're not willing to go as far as becoming a vegetarian or vegan.
Right.
We also talk a lot about, in this edition, in the fish chapter in particular, we talk about sustainability and fish fraud and how, you know, how climate change is affecting our oceans and the seafood that we eat and how to, you know, instead of going to the fish counter and always getting that big, tuna steak or the salmon fillet, you know, getting something a little lower on the food chain, getting things that maybe you're not as familiar with and trying them out. And so we give lots of examples of how to use different fish or how to substitute one fish for another.
I think that's really helpful, especially for fish. I don't know why people are afraid to cook fish, but they are.
They are, absolutely.
You know, as opposed to, let's say, a steak, which you can ruin much easier than a piece of fish. You know,
I think fish are, I mean, I think fish also, they do overcook so quickly, and they are, fish tends to be more expensive than a lot of like chicken or something.
Right.
So people are just scared of ruining it.
Well, I guess you have a point, but you know, I do see that people, you know, even when you go into a restaurant, you know, when it comes to seafood, you know, if you don't have that salmon on the menu, you know, people think there's no fish on the menu. It's a,
right.
I mean, even with an educated clientele. Well, so we talked about sustainability a little bit. Let's talk about, you brought up being vegan or vegetarian, gluten-free, dairy-free. Now all these people who have dietary restrictions, who used to be shunned into the corner, right? Like if you were a vegetarian, you got the carrots. You know, yeah. that's one of my favorite things to say. Like, and you have the, you know, you would have a gorgeous plate of food, the, you know, Chateaubriand, blah, 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 and then you have the carrots. But we are in a very different world, and not only are there restaurants that cater specifically to vegans and vegetarians, but most chefs relish the opportunity to put together well-composed dishes for people with all sort of dietary restraints, including gluten-free or allergies, which are more and more apparent as well. How did you address that in the book?
Well, it was really hard to figure out where to draw the line, just because, I mean, you know, we definitely knew we had to include some gluten-free recipes. And of course, you know, we've always had a very large vegetable chapter. So that's something that we wanted to increase the number of vegetarian and / vegan mains.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think the key with the vegetables chapter is something we tried to do, because before it was a lot of clearly vegetable side dishes that were pretty plain. So like you've got your steamed broccoli, you've got
your roasted
whatever. Mm-hmm. But we really wanted to make more thoughtful recipes for vegetable dishes to make them a little more interesting, because I think people do expect vegetable dishes to have more flavor and to be more interesting now. Mm-hmm. It's not enough to have, you know, the glazed carrots and the peas.
Well, and I also think people need to recognize, just as you were saying, that it can be the center of the plate, and in order for it to be the center of the plate, you can't just roast it.
Exactly.
Not that they're not delicious roasted, they are, but but that they need to be treated as you would a protein.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and also, I mean, a lot of the recipes that we have in the vegetable chapter that do include some meat, we try to give options for how to, you know, work around that. So we'll give specific substitutions or, you know, ways to make a certain dish vegan. So yeah, that's another way that we tried to kind of address that issue.
And interestingly, Marion Becker actually had a bunch of food allergies. And so in the 70s, 60s and 70s, she included quite a few recipes in, especially the baking chapters, for recipes that used rice flour or non-wheat flours, which was something that I had no idea about until I was actually just flipping through the book on my own and found mm-hmm. Rice flour brownie or something to that effect.
Interesting. Well, mm-hmm. as a baker, how did you integrate sort of gluten-free or other options into that part of the book?
We did add a few recipes for gluten-free breads in particular, because that is, baking gluten-free breads is very different than baking yeast mm-hmm. breads. You're almost making, for most recipes, you're making more of a batter than you are a dough, because there's no point in kneading it.
Right.
There's no gluten to be developed, so you don't knead it. But we wanted to do that. But then we also just have some naturally gluten-free baked goods. We didn't want to go whole hog into gluten-free territory, because Joy of Cooking is such a big and comprehensive book that we wanted to give a nod, but kind of have all the classic recipes that Joy is known for. Mm-hmm. And neither of us are gluten-free baking experts. So we didn't want to, we didn't have a ton of space to devote to it either. So that was one reason.
That's the point, right? The point is to acknowledge.
Absolutely.
Right, exactly. And address it. I mean, if you were to use the Joy of Cooking as sort of history books over time, mm-hmm. right? So you could see what people were eating and how they were eating based specifically just on the books and the recipes and narratives you put with them. So I think this is where we are.
It is an interesting time capsule.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm fascinated by it.
An idiosyncratic and potentially inaccurate time capsule, but yes.
Now, let me ask you both, with your research, were there things that you found that just sort of blew your mind, where you were like, I didn't know that, or this has to be in the book because this is, I can't believe I didn't know this, so I don't think people know this.
Hmm. Sweet corn comes to mind.
Right.
So, I mean, you should tell this because I feel like you have a better grasp on it than me.
Well, yeah, so the modern varieties of, hybrid varieties of sweet corn that show up on shelves that, you know, they have a longer shelf life than normal sweet corn does because...
You mean fresh corn?
Fresh corn.
Like Silver Queen.
Like Silver Queen and mm-hmm. all of those different varieties. But the new hybrids are actually the result of nuclear tests. So, actual corn was put around, I'm trying to remember if it was in the Marshall Islands or...
I think it was.
But it was exposed to radiation, and so it was a
genetic
forced,
mutation.
It was a forced genetic mutation that has given us all of the sweet corn that we now have. Not all.
Wow.
I mean, there are obviously...
So is that some, a radiated food?
No.
Well, not now. No. Originally, yes.
Originally, yes.
But now, no.
Okay. Because yeah. there was a huge, in the 80s and 90s,
yeah.
there was a huge thing about irradiated foods because it could extend shelf life, but there wasn't enough study to know whether or not it
right.
could be unhealthy for those ingesting it.
Or, yeah, or like diminish the nutrients that are available to the body. And,
right.
Yeah, that kind of thing.
Fascinating.
Yeah. I thought that was interesting.
That is really interesting. What about some of the other things I think that are really interesting if you go through the stories now or look through your book are sort of the varieties that are available now. So when I was a child, I went to the grocery store. I think there was a green apple and a red apple. I mean, you know, now you go into a grocery store and there's an apples in all variety of names and a lot, you know, that some are good for cooking, some are good for eating, some are good for this and that and the other. And it's not just obviously fruits and vegetables, but we're seeing that throughout the different aisles. How did you incorporate that in the book?
Well, we really tried to account for as much as we could, calling them out by name. I mean, a lot of the time, those apple varieties, I mean, they still fall into three basic categories. You know, you have your crab apple / cider apple, you have your baking apples, and then mm-hmm. you have the ones that are fairly crisp, that, you know, like the honey crisp, that are great for fresh eating. But yeah, we definitely, our farmer's market, there are two vendors in particular that are fantastic. They have, like, one of them is called Old World Apples, and they have a bunch of varieties that go back to, like, some of them go back to the 1500s.
Mm-hmm.
Then we have another one who, I think they're the only vendor in our area that has, what is it called?
Ashmead's Kernel.
Right. Ashmead's Kernel.
Our favorite apple in the world.
Tell me.
Best name, but also extremely tart and mm-hmm. extremely sweet.
And so very crisp.
And crisp.
Yum.
So it is a flavor explosion.
It sounds delicious.
It's fantastic.
No, this is the only reason why I like this season, because I don't like the cold. I know you people are in Portland, but it's because of apple season. I
yes.
love, love, love apples in this region. I mean, not like Washington State, but this region does make terrific apples as well. All right. So what's next for you all? Now that the book is done, your marriage is still intact. And it's not that I'm wishing ill will. I work with my husband. I know what it's like. Trust me. Did you ever did either of you, were you like, I want that recipe in there?
Absolutely. We,
did you
we definitely had arguments. But it's funny. We were trying to recall a specific instance.
You both seem so like calm and gentle. You both seem so nice. Like, if my husband were here, you'd be like, yeah, I don't know how these people stay married. So, like, I'm just sort of curious, like, what was one or two either narratives or recipes that you argued over?
Hmm.
We have been asked this question and have tried to remember a specific instance, and I know we argued about
things,
but now I can't remember.
There's no way you don't remember. I can tell you what my husband did wrong in 1994, like on a Tuesday. Like, I can tell you everything, for real.
I think this project has just been so all-consuming and overwhelming that once, you know, we had the argument, someone won the argument, and then maybe we stewed about it for a while, and then we're like, okay, we got to let it go because we
right,
just got to keep going.
On.
Yeah,
right.
We can't.
So the book is out. You're taking it around. Everybody's getting to talk to you. Everybody's getting to see it. You mentioned a little bit ago that you got another 10 years. So now what's next? Are there offshoots that you can do of this? Do you want to just maintain this and be true? Is there other dreams that you have? Where are you both now?
Well,
and it does not have to be a group answer. That can be a separate answer.
It's definitely vacation time at some
yes.
point. But,
what,
you know,
coming
some,
to D.C. isn't a vacation?
Not on book tour, it's not.
No, some relationship maintenance
with a
right. nice vacation would be good. But
mm-hmm. yeah.
Aside from that, Megan has another job, so I think she's going to be devoting more time to that. But
mm-hmm. Okay.
But yeah, you know, we are discussing the possibility of some side projects that are joy related.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing like super duper firm on that. But
well, what happened with the app? Is it out? Is it available?
You know,
I feel like you brought it up, but you didn't elaborate.
Well, that's a sad story. We
Aww.
spent a long time on it, but because the new edition is coming out,
then
or
you have
is
to
out,
update the. I mean, that's the problem with apps,
yeah.
right?
Well,
yeah,
we would have to update
science.
The app, and our developer unfortunately is no longer doing that kind of thing. They're
mm-hmm.
close friends, and so you know, If we felt like we could get them to do it, I think we would definitely try.
But they're not in that business anymore. Yeah. And, you know, we had a really great arrangement with them because developing an app is extremely expensive if you have to pay for
and
it.
And also extremely time consuming.
Yes. So they developed the app not for free, but for a percentage of sales, which worked out really well because it enabled us to do the project. And we were really proud of it. But with this new edition coming out, we couldn't have that product on the market anymore. So we just had to take it off the App Store.
I understand. Yeah. I really do. Well, I hope that there are other ways that people can access the book other than just the book. I mean, I assume you're doing, I know you're doing lots of other interviews, not just with me. Where are you going tonight? You're going to?
The Smithsonian.
The Smithsonian. Fabulous. And then did you already do Politics and Prose? Are you doing Politics and Prose?
Tomorrow.
Yeah. Okay, great. I knew Politics and Prose was in there somewhere. So what time tonight at Smithsonian?
6 p.m., I believe. Okay. Or 6:30.
Excellent. And then Politics and Prose? Seven. Tomorrow. The one on Connecticut Avenue. Okay, great. So please make sure your books are marked. Of course, you can always check the list or youwantit.com. Both items are on the calendar, so it'll keep you up to date.
Oh, one thing.
Yes.
There is an ebook, just so you know.
There is an ebook.
It's
okay, so what does that mean for the uninitiated? You can just buy it and
you can
have
just buy
online?
It on the Kindle store.
Put it
store.
On your Kindle.
Fabulous. Yeah. Great. Okay, good.
Yeah. So okay. The app is no longer, but we do have the ebook.
Okay, so you still have access online.
Yeah.
Excellent. Okay, can you please tell everybody where they can find you and your book?
Yeah, you can find us at The Joy of Cooking on Instagram and Twitter, and at Joy of Cooking on Facebook and joyofcooking.com.
Excellent. Okay, I want to thank both John Becker and Megan Scott for joining me in studio today. The book is, if you don't have one, holiday season is coming up. So either buy one for yourself as a gift to yourself, or buy one to someone you love who's really either into cooking or getting into cooking. To me, honestly, I gave one to my four older children who, when they moved out of the house and got their own apartments, they all got A Joy of Cooking, because it is the perfect introduction to cooking for yourself and then cooking for others. And as everyone knows, there is nothing better than feeding people. It brings everyone together. So I want to thank you both for joining me in studio today. And I want to let you know that I'll be back here on Monday. I'm kind of fooling around with my schedule a little bit, but I'll be live at 2:00. Lydia Bastianich is going to be in studio with me. We're going to be talking about her new book, and I am so excited about it. So again, I want to thank you for tuning in to Industry Night with Nikki Nellis here at the Gorgeous Line Hotel. Follow me at NYCCINELLIS on Instagram, Facebook, or Twitter, or just follow me around. Have a wonderful week.
Thanks for listening to this program on Full Service Radio, broadcasting and recording from the Line Hotel in Adams Morgan, Washington, D.C. Full Service Radio programming can be accessed live and archived on fullserviceradio.org. Our talk programming is available on most podcast apps like iTunes and Stitcher, and our DJ sets are available on mixcloud.com/fullserviceradio. Full Service Radio features over 30 weekly shows and over 50 local hosts covering every topic imaginable. If you want to be a guest or get involved, email us at info@fullserviceradio.org. Follow us on Twitter @FullServiceRDO, on Instagram and Facebook @FullServiceRadio. Thanks for listening.